Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the summertime season 2023, and the reading is easy. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing some of the sessions from the 2021 HNSA conference.
The Historical Novels Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000. Divided between the adult and CYA categories.
In this session, writer and literary critic Stephen Romay is in conversation with Stephen Carroll and the delightful Pip Williams.
Welcome everyone to this session of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia's conference. I'm Stephen Romay. I write about books and films, mainly for the Australian newspaper. And it's my pleasure today to be joined by two award-winning writers, Pip Williams, whose new book is, if you can see it, The Dictionary of Lost Words, and Stephen Carroll, whose new book is, Oh, short title. If it won the Booker, I think it would be the shortest ever, along with John Berger, who won for G. Right. Now, these books are both, I wouldn't call them alternative histories, but they're different takes on existing histories that perhaps fill in some of the gaps in what we think we know. Pip's is about the compilation of the Oxford English Dictionary, and Steve's is about the writing and publication of the notorious erotic French novel, The Story of O. So before we start, I should mention that there will be time for questions at the end. The final 15 minutes will devote to questions from the audience. Feel free to send in your questions anytime, but I'll wait until the end to ask them. So let's start. As we're at the Historical Novel Society of Australasia conference, I think we should talk about why historical novels matter. Let's start with you, Pip. Ladies first, etc.
Well, I think they matter because history is full of gaps. I think you said it earlier. History is problematic. It always has been, and it's problematic for lots of reasons. It's problematic because the people who write history come from a certain level of education, a certain class, a certain race, you name it. History is, as we know, written by the victors, and it's written by the powerful. And so history is necessarily full of gaps and empty spaces. And I think historical fiction is attempting to explore those gaps and to also ask questions of a history that has been written down at a time when the things that we think are important or fair now were not considered important or fair then. And so historical fiction writers are exploring history, its gaps, its faults, its inadequacies. That's what we do.
Steve?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And also, look, I should say, accidentally, I wound up with a double degree in both English and history. It was because I took so long to get my degree. But I was very lucky because, so I understand, you know, the demands of history writing itself. And I had some wonderful teachers at La Trobe University in the history department, people like Israel Getzler, who took the course in Russian history in 1917, and he was actually there as a kid. He remembers the revolution erupting in St. Petersburg. And so it was a fact that they were fantastic teachers. But at the same time, I'm a novelist, and my loyalty will always ultimately be to the novel. And there will be, often there will be those moments when you're following history, but and you're being dutiful in the way you do it, but it's actually not helping the novel much. And so there's got to be times when you actually take history by the hand and lead it into a kind of land of supposition, which may be acceptable, but a way of actually looking at history at the time in a way that historians often can't do. I should say I'm probably a repeat offender in this respect. When I was doing The Art of the Engine Driver, the central character almost is a train called the Spirit of Progress. And the Spirit of Progress never crashed, but the dictates of the story were such that it had to. And I've got to say there was a certain satisfaction in crashing a train called Progress.
Well, Steve, that leads naturally to another question I had in mind, which is when you as a writer of fiction are dealing with events that did happen and you invent characters who did not exist and put them in a historical context, are there any limits? I mean, how far can you go in using fiction inside a historical story? You can crash a train, okay. But your novel and yours, Pip, both have leading characters who are completely made up. So at what point do you realise you've gone far enough with invention? And part of that also is how loyal do you have to be to the characters in your novels who did exist? Maybe, Pip, we could start with you on that one.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. I think you can go as far as you like with your fictional characters, particularly the ones that are completely fictional. When you have them interacting with people who were real, I think as a novelist you make the decision about how much you are then going to fictionalize those real people, because of course they never interacted with your fictional characters in real life. But if you have a bit of a sense of who those real people were through your research, then you can probably do a pretty good job of understanding how they might have reacted to this particular person or in this particular situation. And I mean, let's be honest, even history, biography, all of these sort of non-fiction forms of writing and investigation are all subjective to a very large degree. They pick and choose what they... People always pick and choose what they want to write about. Historians pick and choose those aspects of history that they think are important. So I think it's wrong to think that history is true and fiction is not. I often think you can sometimes say it's the other way around, because some of the things that fiction does is explore, I suppose, those universal truths, emotional, social, interactional truths that we all understand. And so sometimes when you're writing a fictional character engaging with a real person, that's what you're exploring. You're exploring some of those things that we all understand as human. And so the interaction that you come up with is only going to work on the page if a reader thinks that it's authentic, thinks that it makes sense. And I think that's what we're doing. And perhaps that's where we survive or fall as writers, as fiction writers, is how convincing we can be when we do that. In my book, I had, yes, complete Esme, my main characters were completely fictional. And so it didn't matter what I did with them, as long as they interacted with the history in an authentic way. And I had some real characters, and the way I dealt with them in terms of trying to be respectful to who they were is I tried not to judge them in the first instance, but then I also tried not to put too many words into their mouths that I didn't think they would actually say. So I did have access to a lot of letters. I had access to a lot of detail around James Murray. There's so much written about him, and many of his words in my novel were his words that had been written down at some stage. The main character that I have, I suppose, taken a lot of liberties with was Dieter, or otherwise known as Edith Thompson. Edith Thompson is a real person. She worked on the Oxford English Dictionary from the letter A to the letter Z for about 40 or 50 years of her life. And I could find approximately half a page about her in my research. I had access to her, to letters that she'd written to James Murray and others through the archives and so on. But just in terms of what the average person would be able to access about Edith Thompson, it's about half a page. Mm-hmm. And yet she had this huge impact on the Oxford English Dictionary. And so what I did know about her and her family, I have, I suppose, extrapolated a lot more about who she might have been as a character, and I have fictionalized her quite significantly. I get Esme to call her Dieter, which was never her nickname, and for me that's a way of separating the fictional Edith Thompson from the real Edith Thompson. When she's interacting with Esme, she's referred to as Dieter. When she's interacting around the dictionary and with James Murray, she uses her real name, which was Edith Thompson. I could have given her a pseudonym, but then I would have written her out of history again, and I couldn't bear to do that.
She's a wonderful character, and certainly gets a lot more than half a page in your novel.
Yeah.
Her letters to Esme are wonderful on their own.
Thank you.
I'll go to Steve in 1 minute, but before we leave this with your characters, Pip, I did note that two of the characters you made up are the baddies, Mr. Dankworth and Mr. Crane, both working on the dictionary. I can see each of those being played by Patrick Malahide, right? In a film version. Did you have a bit of fun making up the baddies?
I had fun making up their names. That's a little bit of a nod to Dickens, but no one needs to know that. That was just, it was a little bit of fun making up, especially Mr. Dankworth. I was really proud of that surname.
Yeah, it's a beautiful name, Pip.
It is a very Dickensian name.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Steve, what about you? I mean, you have the real characters you have the woman who wrote the story of O, you have the man who published the story of O or helped to publish the story of O, but you also have an entirely fictional character, an English spy, who is the name used as a pseudonym to write the story of O. You have Albert Camus in there, of course. I brought him along. So you have a lot of real characters and you have fictional characters. How did you make all of that work in a story that, you know, we know a fair bit about already?
Yeah. I wrote about 10,000 words of the first draft, and I was actually in Paris. I was just thought I'd hit the spot. And after about 10,000 words, I thought, I'm bored. This is just not working. And I realised I was following the biography too closely. Mind you, the only biography available was by a French woman called Ange David, and it's in French. So I had to read it with the aid of a French-English dictionary, and it's a bit of a doorstopper. So it actually took a bit of time, and my French is kind of crap. You know, it's sort of fifth form restaurant French. So I did read it though. And I found that I was following history, following the details of the biography far too closely. And it was resulting in a boring book. It's like those essays you write in history, the causes of the First World War, and you've studied every single cause, direct and indirect, and all the rest of it, and your impulse is to include everything. And I think this can often weigh a book down when it's set in the past. My view for research always has been, do your research, yes, then forget it. And what is important will hopefully surface in the writing and be naturally resonant rather than being plonked in. And so when I was when I stopped after about 10,000 words writing I sat down and had a good think about what I'd do with the plot. And that was when I decided to actually take Pauline Réage. Now, Pauline Réage, for those who don't know, was the pseudonym that Dominique Ory used when she published Story of O, because her parents and everybody else would have been absolutely astounded. So she had to have a pseudonym. There's no question about that. But, you know, Dominique Ory was a resistance name, so that wasn't her name either. Her real name was Andy Clough. So it's a kind of like a something out of Lewis Carroll and sort of Hall of Mirrors. So that's quite fascinating in itself. So it gives you a bit of liberty to actually start working with these characters, because they're all using pseudonyms anyway. And so that was when I decided to invent Pauline Réage as a character. And that was when I started to actually consciously, whether it shows or not, introduce the whole sort of thriller element to the early part of the book too, because I've always wanted to write a thriller. And that was when, for me, the book took off. Now, it's counterfactual. Pauline Réage never existed, but I would suppose argue that the spirit of her existed. And I fed her into the book, and Dominique Ory has her, when she chooses her pseudonym, it comes from the interaction between the two of them. It was the thing that kick-started the novel for me. And I don't think it was such a great historical transgression. It's one of those gaps. Who does know? She might have existed. It just could be a really good secret.
It's interesting that you wanted to write a thriller, because your fictional Pauline Réage is also so beautiful that no one can walk down the street without gazing in her direction. So I think you've got a bit of the thriller art going there as well.
I'm wondering, Steve, though, I think Pauline is so essential to your novel, as you do too. You wouldn't have continued it if you hadn't come across her, you just said. But I think this goes to your question, Stephen, about the importance, in a way, of the fictional character within the historical context. Without Pauline and without Esme, we wouldn't have been able to explore the things that we wanted to explore in our stories. So Pauline, for me, I thought she was just wonderful and essential, because she was France, you know, this, yes, this whole idea, yeah, of France sort of subjugating itself during World War One, and this is what this woman, as a sort of femme fatale, you know, sort of underground spy for France, is doing as well. And the fact that you know, I've just thought of it when you said it, the fact that no one could look away from her as she walks down the street. Well, isn't that what France is like for all of us? You know, no one can look away from France. We're all sort of enamored by France. And I just think that that's what the fictional characters do. They allow us to ask those questions of history, yeah, that we can't ask if we just follow the historical record, because the historical record is inadequate to the questions that we've got.
Yes, that's right.
She was just such a wonderful character.
Well, Esme is absolutely brilliant too. This is a mutual aberration society going on here, but Esme is absolutely fabulous. And I think you're a beautiful character. And I'm telling you earlier on that, you know, what I found so impressive about the dictionary is the way, is the momentum that it develops, and just the way Esme becomes layered all the way through. And by the end, you know, it is deeply moving, and that's a sign of a really sure-footed novel, and I just loved it, you know. But I couldn't agree more that we need to actually invent a doorway to actually do the things that an historian can't do, unless it's a kind of highly imaginative historian. And I agree completely with what you were saying before too, that history, we shouldn't rely on history as being the fact. You know, when I was doing my degree, we were always told, don't take anything for granted. Always, Peter Cook especially, at La Trobe University in Australian history, always emphasized using primary resources, don't rely on the secondary, go to the source itself. And if you, you know, if you look at people like, I remember reading Manning Clark's first volume, you know, if you want to think about it, to what extent does history really capture the truth? Well, the truth is a very slippery customer. And I'm not invoking fancy French theory to do that. It just simply is. And if you look at Manning Clark in the first volume and the portrait of Macquarie, you know, it's not a portrait that you'd probably get now. You know, he was seeing Macquarie, Clark that is, through the lens of Shakespeare and the whole F.H. Bradley argument of the fatal flaw. And so that to an extent, Clark was a novelist masquerading as an historian. And his portrait of Macquarie is a kind of a fictional portrait. It's compelling and it's really interesting, but to the degree to which it's true, I don't know, really. I never actually shook hands with Lachlan. And, of course, the portrait of him now would be totally different.
And has been in a couple of recent books.
Yes, that's right. And the way history has marched on, you know. But I think what actually happens with when we invent these characters, Pip, is that we give ourselves entree into history in a way that the historian, unless you're a kind of Clark, can't do or has to be very careful about doing, and in the same way that a biographer has got to be very careful too. But we operate in a different way. We're sort of free agents in that sense. Yes. But, you know, as you were saying, does the novel actually set up a kind of intrinsic truth, one that actually resonates on the page and is contained in the novel itself? And which brings us back to the original question, Stephen, are there limits? I think the novel itself will set the limits in terms, you know, when you're not credible anymore, you know, when it's not working. And so I think it's going to be the novelistic conventions that actually kick in, at least for me anyway, not any kind of historical convention.
I think, by the way, I may be wrong about this, but I think Manning Clark also had Farlap winning the Melbourne Cup twice and he only won it once, but I may be wrong about that. But I think one of the challenges of writing historical fiction is that unless you're writing an alternative history, like, say, Philip K. Dick and The Man in the High Castle where Hitler wins the war, well, people are going to want to read that, of course. Mm. When you're really sticking to the history that people know, you're writing about events where they know the outcome. Like, people know the Oxford English Dictionary was published. People know Story of O was published and they know a bit about the controversy that surrounded it. So my question, I suppose, is when you're dealing with real events that people know in advance, how do you keep the reader glued to the page? How do you sustain their interest in something they already know the result of? And an example that comes to my mind is we all know Anne Boleyn gets her head cut off, but Hilary Mantel keeps you stuck to the page when you're reading the novel. So what are your thoughts on that? And I imagine the invented characters are part of it, but there might be something broader.
Well, because Hilary Mantel isn't writing about Anne Boleyn. She's writing about Thomas Cromwell. So she's writing about, even though we know the history, and we know the history of the dictionary, we know something about Story of O, when, as novelists, we're not actually telling you what you know. We're using that as the scaffold. So, in fact, what you know helps you to read the story, perhaps, because you think you know something and then the novelist tells you something that you didn't know, and there's that kind of factor which keeps you reading. But the other thing that I think we have both done, Steve, in our books is, well, in your book for me, there was the why question. So history hasn't told us why that book was written. And it certainly has never told us. None of the analysis, the historical analysis, has sort of discussed your thesis around this metaphor for France during World War II, which I just, you know, once you write it, I think you say this in the epilogue of your book, it seems in plain sight. It's one of those things that it makes perfect sense to me that that's what was happening. I'd also suggest I'd
Can I just say, I'm so pleased that you think that, because I hummed and hawed for 10 years about that.
I just don't
If
think
one
it.
day I think, oh, that is just too fanciful to believe. And another day I think, no, it's just blindingly obvious. So eventually I just thought, well, if this has got the legs, the only to be a novel, the only way I'm going to find out is actually to write the novel. And if it falls to pieces, it falls to pieces.
It didn't fall to pieces. And as a reader, so in a weird way, we've got that, we can answer this question as a reader and a writer. So for a reader, I was stuck to the page of Steve's book because that thesis made perfect sense to me. And I wanted to see it through. I wanted to see how it developed. I wanted to, and I was interested in the relationships, obviously, within the novel, not just the idea in the novel. And I think so. That's one thing that I think readers stick to historical fiction, because they want to understand the nuance underneath the facts that they know.
Yeah, and I think something that actually I've hope you don't mind, Stephen, if we just chat.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think the things that there's something very interesting in both our books in the sense that we're kind of concerned with the absent present, you know. So I'm concerned. For me, the absent presence is the occupation itself. It's not. It's not something that surfaces in the original text, but it comes out in the key words. Now you've got the absent presence as well as the words that slip through history, and also the sheer importance of words in the way we articulate ourselves and define ourselves, and to an ex and the extent to which the words actually define the course, can define the course of a life. Now, I'd really love to know, Pip, when did this whole business, because I think there is a correlation of absent presences, did this beautiful idea first
Oh.
start to take shape in you?
Well, maybe it was a little bit like your idea because I read The Surgeon of Crowthorne by Simon Winchester, which is
Oh, of course, you say this, yeah.
non-fiction. Yeah, non-fiction. And it's about the relationship between James Murray and one of the contributors. But by the end of it, I had a sense of how the dictionary had been compiled and that it had been compiled, a word had to have been written down for it to make it into the Oxford English Dictionary. And then I thought, hang on, this project started in the 1850s and was finished in 1928. What percentage of published works were written by women up until that time? It would have been a very small percent. And then I realized that also all of the editors and lexicographers were men. There were a few female assistants, but who were they? Who knows? And what I realized really was that it was a gendered project because the data was gendered. So I'm a social scientist. My background is in social science. And I simply was looking at this from a scientific point of view, that the data that they were using was biased towards men's experience. And I looked at the dictionaries on my bookshelf, and it was one of those aha moments. It's like, surely somebody else has thought of this. But I looked fictionally, no, nobody has kind of explored this in fiction before. It would be wrong to say no one's thought of it. There are feminist dictionary scholars out there, one of them with the most beautiful Dickensian name, Stephen, you'd love it. It's Linda Mugglestone.
Oh my God. Now you'd think twice about calling your character
I know. And
that,
Linda Mugglestone has written, she's a scholar, so she's written scholarly works around
wouldn't
dictionaries and how they're compiled. So I did get some sort of validation for my concern about the dictionaries on my shelf from reading that. And that, I suppose, gave me some of the confidence that there would be a story in here. But the thing is, I was interested in what words might have been missing from the dictionary because they hadn't been written down. So words that might have been used in the birthing room or the kitchen or the scullery, you know, places where just women existed and men would never come into. But of course I can't find them because they weren't written down. And so I entered into this sort of fictional world with these gaps in history in mind, wanting to fill them to some extent. Now, some of those words I have come across in slang dictionaries, but even that is such an interesting conversation because, you know, slang, which is often used by the lower classes, was considered not good enough to be in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Both of you write about in each novel about how words have their own history and form their own histories. In yours, Pip, I think it's Esme talking to her father about how words have their own history. And in yours, Steve, there's that lovely conversation between Jean and Dominique about collaborative truth, where essentially they have invented a history. So what do you feel about that? What do you feel about words being essential to the formation of our histories?
Oh, it's everything. I mean, that's what my book is essentially all about. And it's not just collective history, it's about personal history as well. I think there's a point in the book where Esme's talking about the word servant, and her father says, you know, she's a little girl and her best friend is a servant, and she's talking about wanting to grow up and be like Lizzie, her best friend. And her father explains that for Lizzie, being a servant is a good thing, but for her, being a servant is a bad thing. And that's just because of the class difference. And so that word means very different things depending on your class at that moment in time. And so the same word can mean different things to different people, but also words change over time depending on how they're used and who uses them. And the meaning changes and sometimes the actual word can morph. And that's what the Oxford Dictionary actually is, why it's so wonderful, because unlike a lot of other dictionaries, it's a historical text. It shows you a word that we use today and it tells you how it's been used through history, right back to the very first time that they could find a textual source for it. And it actually demonstrates how words evolve. It's fabulous.
Back to Chaucer when it gets rude.
Even before Chaucer, actually, that particular word that we're talking about, am I allowed to say it?
Sometimes the C word.
The C word, yeah. I use it liberally sometimes without thought, and then I'm told at the next Zoom not to use it. but it's a fascinating word, so I'll use it surreptitiously. That word was written down in 1240 something because it was a street sign. So there was a street sign in London. It's now called Magpie Lane, but it used to be called Grope Cunt Lane. Because in London, they used to give lanes and streets the names of the economic activity that took part, the business of that street. So I will leave it to everyone's imaginations to figure out what happened in Grope Cunt Lane. But it was written on the sign, and therefore that is a textual source. But also Chaucer used it as well, and as a euphemism, not as an insult. So that is how that word changed over time. It went from being a benign euphemism to being a vulgar insult. And by the time the men of the Oxford English Dictionary were compiling the words, it was a vulgar insult. And even though it ticked every category for inclusion in the dictionary, James Murray himself refused to put it in. And he was less likely to do that than anybody else. But he refused to put that word in the dictionary, even though it was a very, very old English word. And the shame of that is that by not putting it in, he wasn't allowing the rest of us to understand the history of that word and to know that it hadn't always been used in that way. Yeah, and that it might not be used in that way again, and it is coming to to be used differently as women decide that they don't want it used as an insult anymore, they just want to use it as a euphemism.
Steve?
Oh, I think Pip has just about said it all there. I completely agree that we're wordsmiths, so we're dealing with these things, these slippery signifiers every time we sit down to write. But they are absolutely pivotal, like I was saying before. And they probably come about, if you're looking sort of, you know, the origins of language and words and the way we define ourselves, you know. I mean, if you think about it, without the existence of what we might loosely call the other, there's simply no need for language, because, you know, this is what Sartre was vaguely alluding to when about hell being other people. And then without the other people, without the other, there is no need for us to say good morning or get lost. There's no need to actually form language. We just live inside our heads. But once we've actually let it out of our mouths and language begins to form, it's absolutely crucial in letting people know what we think, how we articulate our lives and how our lives progress. And regarding the C word, I've got in one of my T.S. Eliot novels, A World of Other People, the character Iris, who's kind of loosely based on Iris Murdoch, is lying in bed contemplating the word itself, and she actually loves it, and she loves, as Pip said, that Chaucerian ring that the word has, and it's just so unfortunate that the word actually acquired such a negative aspect to it. I remember in the really 1970s at university, talking with a really strong feminist, and she was saying she wanted the word banned, and I was telling her, well, you know, look, you know, you can call a woman that, you can call a guy a prick too, but she said, no, the way it's used now, it is so insulting. So it's most unfortunate that a really rich, poetic, Chaucerian word has now suffered this fate.
I think it might be having a comeback. I think people are reclaiming it. But one other thing about words and how they evolve and change, which I think is really important to this question of history, is that as we start to open up our hearts and minds to the other, to First Nations people, to immigrants, to people from different cultures and backgrounds and languages, to ourselves, our language changes. Yes. So we are now using various words from, you know, Indigenous, Aboriginal, Australian culture. Deadly, for instance, is now coming into the, you know, common lexicon. Fantastic. Other words which would be, you know, from Aboriginal language, in fact, which, you know, wouldn't that be wonderful if we were using more Indigenous words in our everyday language? I'm sure there are words from various immigrant populations that become part of our Australian English language. And that tells us something about our history. You know, in 100 years to come, if someone is looking at the dictionaries that are being developed right now, if they are true to the language that we are using across the board, then they will be able to understand a little bit of what was going on at our time in terms of who was here and how language was evolving because of it. I think it's fantastic that English is so flexible in that way.
And a sign of a healthy language too. It's a healthy sign.
Yes, I think so.
I think one of the things that historical fiction does as a reader and I will ask you whether it does it for you as a writer as well, is it takes you to that moment in history. You inhabit it. You become part of that community, that country, that time, for example. And I'll tell you a slightly funny story to me at least, Steve, with O. There's a very brief scene where Dominique goes into a cafe when she knows she shouldn't have gone into, it's too risky, and she orders onion soup. And I read that, and without word of exaggeration, after I finished that sequence, I got up and made myself some onion soup, which I've never done before. And I don't know if I did it correctly. I basically chopped up an onion and boiled it. But it was because you took me to that cafe, that moment, and even though she only has one sip of it in the novel, I just wanted to be there as well and try that soup. So I did. And I think with Pip too, your novel makes me want to go to that time as sort of a time I'd like to be in anyway, but a time where there's a little bit more kind of decorum in the world in some ways. Anyway, so to ask you, is that part of the skill of writing historical fiction to take readers, they're not just reading about it, they're inhabiting it?
I'll let you start, Stephen.
That's one of the most wonderful responses I've ever got from a reader, Stephen. And you took the trouble to make onion soup afterwards. I think this is fabulous. This is the thrill of doing this. I'm sure historians get a thrill out of trying to recreate history in their way too. But the real charge, the real kick is actually trying to actually create the situation as you imagine it might have existed. And that scene actually came about through an interview that Dominique Henry did with a French woman, I've forgotten her name now. But again, it was in French and I had to actually read it in French, and I'm hoping I got it right. But she was saying she nearly got arrested. And you might not, I mean, what she was doing was distributing illegal anti-German leaflets. And you might think that's not particularly dangerous, but it could have got a shot. In fact, Jean Paulhan's assistant on the Midnight Publishing, illegal publishing, was arrested, the usual hour, about 11 or 12 at night by the Gestapo, taken into police headquarters and shot at dawn. And that was for distributing illegal literature. Now, she had a satchel full of illegal literature on a particular day. She was hungry, it was cold, and she succumbed to actually going in to the restaurant and having onion soup. Because it was like it was out the front, you know, and she'd no sooner sat down than the French police arrived, and they were more zealous than the Gestapo. Quirk of history there, and she was absolutely petrified because she knew if she was caught, she would certainly go to jail, possibly a concentration camp, or possibly just get shot. Now, what I did in there was also invent another woman who comes in, a very young woman, who sits opposite her, and she's the one who's arrested. And it's a heart-wrenching scene for her to watch, because I think, you know, she was an astonishing character, Dominique Henry. And you've got to realise that Story of O was never meant to be published. It was just a love letter. It's like you've got to imagine two lovers lying in bed and just discussing their fantasies or their dreams, you know. And that's what she did. She just put it down, and it was Jean Paulhan who wanted it published. She is such a fascinating character. She said it was visceral when the Germans came in. She wasn't political, but she was certainly a patriot. And when the Germans came in, it was a visceral response and she had to do something. And this is an astonishingly sophisticated intelligence. This is a woman who read Proust every year for 5 years. I've only ever read Proust once and I'm not going to do it again, you know. but she did it every 5 years and she intimidated people. And I was speaking to, when I did the research for this, I was talking to Philippe Soleuse. Now, he's a huge writer in France. And when I interviewed him, it was actually inside Gallimard. So it got me inside what is a lot of people regard as almost like a wing of government. It's such a huge and important publishing house. And he's married to Julia Kristeva. So you know, there's a bit of a power couple in terms of literature. But he was intimidated by Dominique Henry. She didn't say much, she didn't do much, but she just radiated this air of astonishingly sophisticated reading. She was almost ready-made. She helped me. And in terms of actually creating the scene, creating the character, the two things do it. For me anyway, the character's got to be standing up. And the big moment for me when I was actually doing the book was when I actually realised that these two were almost masquerading as being human. They're forest creatures. From the moment I saw them as forest creatures, he the owl, she the wildcat, from that moment on, the characters took off and that became my way into their characters and hopefully just making it a vivid reading experience.
I think right at the start, when the owl first meets the cat, he suggests that she reads too much Proust.
Remembering.
Not that you want to judge your characters, Steve.
I like the owl. I like the cat too. Anyway, Pip.
Well, yeah, so you were talking about language taking you back to a time in history.
To transporting you to that moment in history.
Yeah, so important, but also very important not to labour it, because I think, I'm sure my early drafts would have been full of research and language that I felt I wanted to put in because I'd actually figured it out. You know, I'd found that interesting, interesting bit of information, or I'd read something that had a bit of dialect or something in it. But I think it's important to have to pepper some of that stuff through a story that's going to be read by a modern audience, rather than to fill it, because you can take a person out of a story, I think, if what you're focusing on is the details of the history and not the details of your story, if that makes sense. And even though you might have spent hours and hours collecting all those wonderful details of history, I think that's the hardest thing maybe for a historical fiction writer. And it was for me at times. The hardest thing was to say, I don't need that in the story. The story isn't benefiting from that wonderful piece of information that took me 3 days to find.
So it's a historical darling you have to kill.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And also the other thing that I have learned through writing that book and the book I'm writing at the moment is also to read. It's to, where's he gone?
I'm here. Hanging in my laptop. As we were.
The other thing is also to sort of write from the inside of the story rather than the outside. So if your character at that moment in time wouldn't have noticed something because it was every day to them, then you shouldn't be noticing it as a writer. Does that make sense? So yes. It's like your character shouldn't say, oh, what a beautiful Edwardian doorknob. because it was just a doorknob. And so as a writer, you don't describe the doorknob as Edwardian or in any way, actually, because your characters aren't going to find it interesting or extraordinary in any way. And I think sometimes that's the trick. It's knowing what elements of history make sense to put in from your character's point of view rather than from someone who's living in the 21st century's point of view.
Yes. If I can perhaps provide further illustration there. Well, at one point in the train journey from Paris to Normandy, one of the characters remarks on the slowness of the train, and there was dialogue in there to the extent that another character responds by saying, "Oh yes, we're going slowly because the coal burns more slowly, and coal is in short supply." And when I gave that to my partner Fiona Cat to read, she said, "Get that out, take it out straight away. It's totally unnecessary, and they would not have said it at the time."
No, but I'm imagining you reading that and finding that out and going, "Oh, that's so interesting."
That's right.
That's a train in it.
Fascinating.
That's so fascinating. Everyone will find it fascinating. And you do that. You do that all the time. There's so many fascinating things that I've had to cross out.
That's right. You know, when John Fowles was writing The Frenchless Tenth Woman, he decided to do no research whatsoever when he did his first draft, because he thought it was really important to actually get the story going and get the character standing, and then you could go back and do your research then. And a really interesting, he's written about this, because I love The French Lieutenant's Woman. I think it's a magnificent novel.
Me too.
He said that when he went back to actually research the dialogue for that novel, he decided that, because it's set in 1867, and he was writing in 1967, he decided the dialogue in 1867 really wasn't that much different the dialogue. Mm. Is this what you found as well?
Very much so. And in fact, I'm reading, because of the book I'm writing at the moment, I'm reading literature that my characters might have read. So, for instance, the Brontes, who were writing around that time. The real difference is, you know, it's slightly more formal, and everybody is Mr. and Miss and, you know, these sorts of things. They also used to, and this has just been annoying me the whole time I've been reading, the Tenant of Wildfell Hall recently, which is a wonderful feminist novel, extraordinary. But
ahead of its time.
This is such a tiny thing, but, you know, they'll have dialogue and they always end with "said she, said he." And I just love how we've just switched that to "he said, she said." But anyway, it's not so different. And I think it's very easy just to put in, and I think dialect is a bit, or, you know, kind of working class accents are different. Mm. I think for me, what I did with the dictionary, with Lizzie, but also Mabel, there are a few working class characters in that book. I just gave them one or two speech habits that are borrowed from their class or their accent, rather than everything they say being in that mode, and that is enough for a reader to understand where they sit in the class system, or whether or not she's got an Irish accent or an English accent.
We're coming 10 minutes to go, but I can't see any questions yet. If the audience has any questions, please send them in, but I'll ask one to keep us going until they come in. And it's interesting what you were talking about then, Steve, about Fiona Capp, your partner, telling you to take something out of the novel. You've both written these novels. You've taken a slight extra risk in that they are historical, so you're messing around with history as well as fiction. And I couldn't help but notice in O, when Dominique is talking about the book being published, and she writes that being published, there's something vulgar in it, undignified and unsettling, like those dreams of finding yourself naked in a public place. Whenever you put words on a page, you are always laying yourself bare. Strangers will read it, irrespective of whom it was written for. They will make their own snigger and snort. They will make it their own snigger and snort. So, is that what it's really like? Do you really feel like you're naked on a public stage when your novel goes out into the world and is read by anyone who wants to?
Steve,
You want to go, Pip?
you've got so much more experience of this than I do, but this is my first novel, but it's sort of my second and a half book. When my first book came out, that was just mine, and it was memoir, actually, and so I should feel much more like that. I felt like that before it came out. I thought that's how I'd feel, but as soon as it was published, there was a separation between me and the book, even though it was memoir, and I felt the same way with the novel. It's almost like, for me, when the book is finished, I feel like it's 75% done, and it won't be finished until it's read by someone. And so every reading will be slightly different. And you were saying earlier, Stephen, about some of those things that you haven't even thought of that are in your book. You know, you haven't purposely put them in necessarily, but a reader will pick up themes of their own accord because of their own experience, their own life experience. And that's where I think a book is finished off. So in a way for you, Stephen, Storyvo was finished off when you got this idea about France. And I love that idea. And for me, I started reading Story of O after reading O, and I have to admit, I haven't finished it. I'm finding it hard going. And
Beyond the call of duty
I know, I'll tell you
to
why.
Pip.
I'm glad it was published, absolutely. I would never be somebody who would ban any kind of book, but I understand the controversy around this book, but at the moment, to read it now during the Me Too era is a very different experience. I'm bringing that to my reading of this book. And, you know, where there's this idea about submission, I now read it as coercive control. There's this sense of coercive control in there that I can't actually get away from. And it's a fascinating thing to think about how a book is finished by a reader, depending on their experience, their gender, their cultural background, etc.
Sorry to be the bell ringer, but we only have 5 minutes, and I do have some audience questions now, so we should get to them because they've been kind enough to listen. One from Sarah Thornton, who may well be the novelist Sarah Thornton, but I'm not sure. Writing about real people, have you ever had negative reactions from their living descendants? Quick answers, please.
No.
No.
Okay. Have you ever worried about it?
A little, but I think descendants from someone who didn't have their own children, and so they're very far removed. I'm not sure that any one person has the right to speak on behalf of someone a few generations before them in some ways. I was a little worried, but as long as I'm respectful in my writing of somebody, that's my job.
Okay.
Done.
Main thing
Question.
I've ever been worried about is the Elliott Estate, actually. The very first thing I ever wrote was a play about T.S. Eliot, the writing of The Wasteland, and in his first marriage. It was sent to the Elliott Estate, and I got a letter back from a certain Mavis E. Pindard, who said, "We note 67 quotes from Mr. Eliot's work. You will withdraw them forthwith, or we will sue," or something like that. And so I've always been a bit wary of alluding to Eliot's poetry, but very rarely quoting it.
Carol Lander asked a question I think fits into this, which is, it takes a while to write a historical novel. Do you worry that someone else will beat you to the punch? And I think that has happened to you, Steve,
Yes, that's
with the
right.
Eliot play.
With the Eliot play, because I thought, look, I just thought nobody would be interested in T.S. Eliot, his first, this is what, 1980, T.S. Eliot, his first, the writing of The Wasteland, his first wife, and his first wife. By the time I'd finished the third draft of the play and it was ready to actually go on at a theatre company in Melbourne, a play opened in London about T.S. Eliot, his first marriage and the writing of The Wasteland, and that, of course, was Tom and Viv. And so my play was withdrawn from production. It went on the ABC. Pamela Reid was in it, but it's never seen the stage at all. So I was aware of that when I was doing O. You're not the only one with an idea.
Yes. I was nervous because I couldn't believe no one had had this idea before. So I was very happy when I got the draft done.
Get in first.
All right, we're coming to an end now, and we've got 2 minutes until the close. So
could I read something?
It's absolutely. You've got 1 minute.
Yep. Because I think it sums up, in a way, what historical fiction's doing. It's early on, and it's about a Jewish woman that Jean is about to publish from the underground. And he writes, "The poor woman, she writes without hope of anyone ever reading her, but still she writes. We owe this to her and ourselves." And I kind of think that's what historical fiction is about. It's about those people who wrote into a void, or thought into a void, or lived into a void, and thought they would never end up in history. And that's what historical fiction does.
And you know the character I had in mind, and thank you so much for picking that out. The character I had in mind was Irene Nemirovsky, who, when she wrote Suite Française, she had no sense of a readership at all because she was hiding in Vichy France. And that book was discovered in a suitcase well after she died. So it's kind of like it's playing with history, and actually, rather than the book not being published in a lifetime, it is published in a lifetime through the agency of the character that you invent.
Yeah.
But Pip, I asked you early on, I love the little details. What stage did the lorry have to come across Westminster Bridge?
5 seconds.
Esme was always going to die when the dictionary was published.
All right, we're being shut down now. I just want to say thank you, Steve and Pip. That was an extremely enjoyable and thought-provoking session. And thank you to all the readers who tuned in. Hope to see you next year.
Thanks, Stephen. That was great. It was lovely.
Thank you, Pip.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, Summer Season 2023. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.